explicit and categoric about it. And it's obvious if you stop to think about it. Because he was the living God. Jesus Christ uniquely among all the religious leaders of the world. We don't have time to go into the uniqueness of Christianity and Jesus Christ, but that's a fascinating subject in itself. He uniquely, however, among all the leaders of the world, declared himself to be God. None of the others did. They were emphatic, as a matter of fact, that they weren't, but Christ said he was. And if he was, it's obvious that he's the only way to God. He's the only bridge between the moral gap between highest human achievement and the infinite holiness of God. Jesus Christ is the only way to God because he is the Son of God. And the third thing we need to help people to see is perhaps an illustration of this, to see the difference between inherent laws and socially determined laws. Dorothy L. Sayers makes the point in her book, The Mind of the Maker, actually, points out this distinction. Suppose there's a stop sign out here in this intersection right outside the camp. The community gets together, passes a law, and says the penalty for going through that stop sign is $15. Now, the penalty is not inherent in the act of going through the stop sign, is it? That is socially determined. The community could vote to raise the fine to $25, reduce it to $5, or abolish it completely. But suppose we passed a resolution here before the floor unanimously that the law of gravity would be suspended from 9 to 10 tonight. And we passed it unanimously three times to be sure. Who would join me in going up to the roof and take a leap to enjoy this newfound weightlessness from 9 to 10? Obviously, none of us would we? Why? Because this is not socially determined. The effect of the violation of the law of gravity is not something you vote on. It's an inherent physical law of the universe. And just as there are inherent physical laws, there are inherent spiritual laws, and this is one. Jesus Christ is the only way to God. It's not something that's socially determined, that the Christians could change by unanimous vote. I hope you follow me on that. If not, we can talk about it later. A third question that comes up with increasing frequency, and this is true particularly among scientists today who are no longer so much concerned with the problem of miracles, though that's still a question. The thing that is bugging a lot of people today since the advent of the bomb is, what about the problem of evil? How can a good God allow the world to be in such a mess? Either God is all good but not all powerful, and therefore he can't stop the mess we're in, or he is all-powerful but not all-good, and he doesn't. In any case, he's not the God you describe as being all-powerful and all-loving, the classic statement of the problem of evil. Well, how are we going to answer this question? Again, I think we must admit initially that we do not have the full answer. Nobody but nobody has got the full answer to the whole problem of the origin of evil and its nature in the world today. As C.S. Lewis has pointed out, we can haggle endlessly about the origin of evil. The thing we have to face up to is that we're stuck with the fact of evil, and we must come up with a solution to the fact of evil. And that we have in Jesus Christ. On the other hand, again, there are some indications in the Scripture as to the direction in which the answer to this question lies. We must see that man, not God, is responsible for evil. Man was created perfectly by God, with the freedom of choice. He was free to obey God or to disobey him. Had he chosen to obey God, there never would have been any evil in the universe. But he chose to disobey God, brought disaster into the universe. Every one of us has ratified that decision. And the nature of the universe in which we are put is such that every man's action influences everyone else. We live in an orderly universe. We do not live in a universe where each person's actions can be interrupted and its impact on other people eliminated. Otherwise, it would be as chaotic as, again, C.S. Lewis points out, as trying to play a game of chess and changing the rules after every move. The thing would be completely meaningless, you see. We are the ones who are responsible for evil. Had we not sinned, we would never have had evil. Now, as we pointed out the other night, God could have created us like chatty dolls. He pushes the right button and we say, I love you. Yes, I do what's right. But we wouldn't have been men. There would have been no volition to the whole thing. We'd have been automata. We would not have been men. Thirdly, God could stamp out evil tonight very easily. He, at midnight tonight, could stamp out all evil. But which of us would be here at 12:15 if he did? You see, we want God to stop wars and this and that and the other thing, but in God's sight, evil is evil. And when God's time comes to eradicate evil, it's going to be total. And every one of us would be consumed if God were to move in. And it's of His mercy that we are not consumed, as the writer to the Hebrews says. And it's His day of grace that is extended that we may still, as men who have rebelled against Him, come back to our Father who loves us because of what He has done for us in Jesus Christ. And the last thing we need to observe is that God has done the most sensational and dramatic thing possible to meet the problem of evil in Himself coming into this universe which is racked with evil and dying on a cross in order that we might be reconciled and the problem of evil can be righted and solved in our hearts and lives personally. We need, as we said the first night, a power strong enough to change human nature to meet the problem of evil, and that God has done for us in Jesus Christ. And so if a person is ultimately concerned with the problem of evil, he can contribute to its solution by himself coming into personal vital contact with Jesus Christ. God cannot be blamed for evil. We are the ones who are responsible for it. He has done everything to meet it. And as we said earlier, in terms of the illustration of the cross barring the entrance to hell, if we refuse it, we have no one to blame but ourselves. Fourth question that comes up very frequently is, how can you believe in miracles in an age of modern science? Isn't this extremely naive, etc., and so forth? The basic question that is in a person's mind is, how do you know God exists? Don't ever get faked out into discussing the relative merits or logicalities of Jonah and the great whale or Christ feeding the 5,000 out of 5 loaves and 2 fish and so on. That's not the crucial root issue. The crucial issue is God or no God. Every person makes two assumptions or makes an assumption. Either they assume God or they assume there is no God. And everything hinges on that particular assumption. Until you get straightened out there, you don't really get straightened out further down the line. We must help a person to see that if God exists, He is free to intervene in the world and the universe which He has created. He is not a prisoner of His own creation. Natural law is not something which has in itself inherent force. Natural law is simply that which we observe that God has put into the universe. God is the author of natural law. Natural law is not the author of God. God is free to intervene into this universe if He so chooses. Many people, without realizing it, have made an assumption that eliminates this possibility, but they have made this as a presupposition and do not realize that their conclusion and feeling and so on is a presupposition rather than something that is forced by facts. Now, how do we know God exists, basically? It'd be interesting if we had the time, which we don't, for us to ask ourselves, how would we answer the question, how do you know that God exists? Well, there's the argument from design, there's the argument from cause and effect, etc. We won't have time to go into those tonight, but the conclusive way we know that God exists is that He has visited this planet personally in Jesus of Nazareth. We have a clue in recorded history. This God, whom we can never know if He exists unless He chooses to reveal Himself to us, has broken into human history in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. We have the record of this person. We find that He made staggering claims about Himself, and we cannot get around them without facing up to them. We won't have time to elaborate in great detail, but let me suggest this. There are only 4 possibilities with reference to the claims of Jesus Christ to deity. He was either a liar, a lunatic, a legend, or the truth. He either knowingly deceived people when He told them He was God, which the average person won't take as a live option because he immediately hastens inconsistently if he denies the deity of Christ to tell you that He was a great moral philosopher, teacher, etc. Or he was a lunatic. He was just sort of out of it. He had lost contact with reality. He thought he was God, but he wasn't. He was obviously sincere. We call that paranoia or megalomania. We know what the clinical symptoms of this are today, and there's a total absence of that kind of symptom in the life of Jesus Christ. The third possibility is that it was a legend. He never really said these things in the first place. The problem with that is that modern archaeology has shown us that the New Testament documents, the 4 Gospels, have been written within the lifetime of contemporaries of Christ, and we don't have the time lag necessary for the legend. And the only other possibility is that He spoke the truth. And when a person says, I don't believe in Jesus Christ, throw it back to them and say, well, that's interesting. Which of the only other 3 possibilities do you believe, and what evidence can you suggest to me to support your position? Do you believe He was a liar, a legend, or a liar, a lunatic, or a legend? And you know, it's amazing the number of people will say, well, you know, I never thought of it like that before. I'm going to have to give this some more thought. It's not quite as simple as I thought it was. They think that there's some limbo position out here that they can adopt, say they don't believe in Jesus Christ, and they don't realize that they're automatically affirming one of the only other 3 possibilities. Remember that in witness as well as in athletics, the best defense is a good offense. Learn to ask a few questions as well as answer them, and you'll find an amazing number of people who haven't thought through their own position and can be stimulated to think as they ask them, as you ask them this. The claims of Christ are in themselves substantiated by the fact of the resurrection. We won't have time to go into the evidence for the resurrection. You'll find that in that book, Who Moved the Stone? But this is a crucial thing. Suffice it to say that many people explain the resurrection by saying that the disciples had a hallucination. They so intensely wanted to believe this thing that they sort of talked themselves into it, which is the way a hallucination happens. Just remember this one fact, which really rocked me when I first realized it, and I suddenly realized that this thing was the truth. This was precisely the one condition, namely the intense desire to believe something that was absent with the disciples. You remember in John 20 when Mary came to the tomb on Sunday morning? What did she have in her hands? She had spices in her hand. Why did she have spices? Because she was expecting to find Jesus Christ alive? No. She was expecting to anoint a dead body. And if you'll recall, she didn't even recognize him when he appeared to her. She thought he was the gardener. Read at your leisure Luke 24, 36 and following. The appearance of Jesus Christ to the disciples on the seashore. They thought they were seeing a ghost. They were scared out of their minds. And our Lord had to say to them, "Handle me and see, for a spirit doesn't have flesh and bone as you see I have." And then there's the classic case in John 20 of Thomas the Doubter. You remember him? He wasn't there when the Lord appeared to the disciples in the upper room. And they went and they told him, "We've seen Christ alive." And he said, "Oh, you know, it's been a long day, boys. Let's not pull that stuff. I'm an empiricist. I'm from Missouri. I don't believe unless I'm shown. Unless I can put my finger in his hand and my hand in his side, I will not believe." He wasn't about to have a hallucination. And you know the rest of the story in the end of John 20. The very condition necessary to have a hallucination was totally absent in the hearts and lives of the disciples. I commend to you a book that's very, very valuable, Basic Christianity, by this man John Stott we've been talking about. It's got a lot of helpful material about the resurrection and other things. It will help you to understand the gospel message more clearly than any other book I know. It's helped a great many Christians, and hundreds of students in many countries around the world have come to know Jesus Christ through this book, Basic Christianity. It's in the book table in there for $1.25. We won't have time to go into some of these things in greater detail. I commend this book highly to you. Let's make one other observation in terms of this question about how do we know God exists and how can we prove God. Let's slow a person up and define what we mean by prove. The average person, without realizing it, is saying, "You can't prove God by the scientific method, and therefore, it's illogical to believe in God," but he is making a materialistic presupposition unwittingly. He is taking the position without realizing that unless you can verify something by the scientific method, it is not reality. And this is, of course, nonsense on further reflection. The scientific method is quite limited in its application, namely, only to those things that are measurable. Who has ever seen 3 pounds of love or 2 feet of justice? Have you? I never have. And neither has anybody else. There are many things that are not verifiable by the scientific method because they don't fit that method. They are incapable of verification. Again, something to be verified by the scientific method must be repeated. If you do one experiment, don't expect to get the Nobel Prize. You've got to be able to repeat this thing, and other people have got to be able to repeat it, and so forth and so forth. To be verifiable by the scientific method, you've got to be able to repeat it. History, in the nature of the case, is non-repeatable. Nobody's ever going to run Napoleon through again, or George Washington. So you could say with tremendous dogmatism, "You can't prove Napoleon." You know, so what? Who said you could? You see, nobody's talking about proving Napoleon by the scientific method because history is non-verifiable by the scientific method. It's an area of reality outside of that method for verification. And to insist that we verify everything by the scientific method, even though they don't fit, is like saying, as J.B. Phillips said, that you must measure chlorine gas with a microphone. It's ridiculous. That's not what the microphone is made for. The microphone is constructed for a particular function. It does it well, and if you try to press it outside that, you make yourself foolish. Same way with the scientific method. Now, there is a science of history. And by the science of history, we know, for instance, as Professor Cadbury at Harvard has said, that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the best attested fact of ancient history. But help people to see that when they're talking about proving God, what they mean without realizing it is proved by the scientific method, and this is an impossibility. Nobody says you can prove God. You can't prove it in the absolute sense in that respect. Quickly, fifth question, how can you accept the Bible when it's full of errors, etc., etc., etc.? The first thing to do is ask the person which particular error they had in mind. Nine times out of ten, you'll find that they really haven't discovered any personally, but they have heard that it's full of errors, and you don't want to be cute at this point, but just ask them that question to help them to see that maybe they have accepted hearsay evidence without personal verification and investigation. They may have a particular one, in which case you may not have the answer. Again, tell them that you'll be glad to look it up. There are various books on difficulties in the Bible. Torrey has one. There's one by Haley, John B. Haley, H-A-L-E-Y, Alleged Discrepancies in the Bible. It's a big tome. You may be able to get information a little more easily by talking to somebody about it. But you will find, as I say, that very often people aren't concerned with that particular or a specific one because they don't know about it. They've just heard it. The thing we want to do as Christians is not to try to prove the Bible is the Word of God before we say anything. That's the last stop on the trolley line for a person, generally speaking. It's a matter of faith, and it comes after we receive Jesus Christ and we see what view he had of the Scripture. All we need to do to confront a person with Jesus Christ is to show him that these four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are accurate historical documents. And that can be done relatively easily. A book that's extremely worthwhile is The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? By Professor F.F. Bruce, in which he suggests, he's one of the leading New Testament scholars in the world today, holds the John Rylands Chair of New Testament at Manchester University in England. He compares the manuscriptal evidence for Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, Homer, Herodotus, etc., other ancient documents that are accepted without question, and shows how scarce is the evidence in terms of numbers of manuscript and age. For instance, there's 900 years between the time Homer wrote and the oldest manuscript we've got. With the New Testament, we've got thousands of manuscripts that go back to the 3rd century and fragments that go way back into the early 2nd century and so on, and there is absolutely no question about the reliability of the New Testament. It helps to have a few of those facts at your fingertips, and as I say, you become a world authority overnight, whereas the average person really doesn't know anything about it. You don't need to be afraid of that question. The New Testament is reliable. You can dig up some information on it and help a person to see that he can't just, if he's going to be intellectually honest, throw it out of court. Part of this is the whole question of evolution. How can you believe in the Bible when we see evolution is true, etc., etc.? I never get involved in the question of evolution. I ask a person one question. Let's assume that you believe in the theory of evolution. What are you trying to conclude from this? Are you trying to conclude that God is not a reality and that this whole thing came into being by chance? If you are, then I will discuss it with you because I think that's naive in the extreme, and I think all the evidence we have is to the contrary, particularly as we confront the evidence for Jesus Christ. If the person says, well, no, God is the one who started this whole thing and is the creator of the universe, then I don't get into a big discussion with him at this point because this is not the issue. The issue is his relationship to Jesus Christ. All I am concerned with is that God created it. I am not so concerned with how God did it. I don't think the Bible is tremendously explicit as to how God did it, but it's tremendously explicit that God did it. And that's the point we want to establish in conversation with a non-Christian and avoid getting involved in esoteric discussions that lead us very far afield. The sixth question is this. How do you know that Christian experience isn't all just a psychological phenomenon, that Freud was not right, that belief in God is simply a father projection, your Christian faith is merely wish fulfillment, the whole thing is a subjective experience, you're a victim of auto-hypnosis, there is no objective reality to the Christianity you profess, and it's all a psychological phenomenon. You could get the same response from this microphone up here if you believed that microphone was God, read the same qualities into this microphone that you read into your Christian God, you'd get the same effect. Furthermore, you've been conditioned by your environment, and all of your responses can be explained by that, like Pavlov's dogs. You remember, they fed them food, rang the bell at the same time. They saw the food, they salivated, they heard the bell. Later, they got away from giving them the food. They withdrew the food, still rang the bell, and they still salivated. See, they were conditioned in their reflex action. And this is the explanation of your situation. You've been to church, Sunday school, etc., etc., and you've come to your position this way. Well, this is a very crucial question that we must think through, and it's one that really throws a lot of us when we first hear about it, because we don't know what the answer is, and it sounds so tremendously plausible. In many areas, we must realize, just to throw this in parenthetically, that description is not the same thing as explanation. There are a lot of people who fail to make that distinction. The fact that you can describe something doesn't explain how it happened and so forth. But nevertheless, this is something that we need to think through, and this is where, as I said earlier, we've got to see how the objective evidence for Christianity and the subjective verification hold together and must be kept in balance and in tension. Suppose somebody came walking through those folding doors there, or sliding doors, if they were open, with a fried egg over his left ear. And he waltzed in here and he said, "Boy, this fried egg is absolutely the greatest. I get peace, power, satisfaction, forgiveness of sins, purpose in life, direction. I mean, this is the greatest. This fried egg is the most. You know, you really ought to have this fried egg." Well, what are you going to say to the guy? You can't knock his experience, you see, because he could tell you, just like this blind man, "Well, you can knock the fried egg all you want, but all I know is yesterday I didn't have the fried egg and I was a mess, and today I do have the fried egg, and boy, you know, I've got it." You see, if all you've got is experience, you're in trouble. This is why your Christian experience, on the other side of the coin, however, is also so powerful, because people can't argue with experience. If you say you've had it and you seem to give evidence of having it, well, boy, you have it, you know, even though you can't explain it. But there are two questions this fellow with a fried egg should be able to answer, and there are two questions that we as Christians have got to be able to answer on the same vein. They're honest questions. First of all, my friend with the fried egg here, is there anything outside of yourself that would be any indication that your experience is something more than auto-hypnosis? Is there any fact or something outside yourself and your own experience? Well, I suspect he wouldn't have anything. I don't know. I don't think the frying pan would be too much help in establishing a basis for this experience, but when it comes to you and me, the case is entirely different. Our subjective experience of Jesus Christ is tied into an objective fact of history, namely the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Jesus Christ rose from the dead in history. And it's because Jesus Christ rose and is alive tonight that you and I can experience him personally. This whole thing is not limited to subjective experience. It is based on an objective fact, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And as you tie those things together, you find that our experience is not purely subjective, but it is based on this fact which is outside of ourselves. And as you tie those things together, you find that our experience is not purely subjective, but it is based on this fact which is outside of ourselves. It is an objective thing to us, but which can be experienced personally and subjectively. The second question we want to ask our friend with the fried egg is there anybody else who's gotten the same thing out of this fried egg? Well, I doubt that he'd have too many people around. You know, H.A. Ironside one time was preaching in the open air, and an atheist began to really give him a hard time and so forth and so forth, and Ironside said, "Well, my friend, tomorrow night let's get together. You bring 100 men whose lives have been revolutionized by atheism, and I will bring 100 men whose lives have been revolutionized by Jesus Christ." Ironside showed up and the other fellow didn't appear because nobody else had been revolutionized by atheism. Nobody has been revolutionized by the fried egg, but we could introduce any of our friends to dozens of people whose lives have been revolutionized by Jesus Christ. They bear uniform testimony to the fact that the change that has come into their lives, like Dave Dawson was telling us the other night, was through Jesus Christ. Furthermore, we will find that these people come from every conceivable kind of background and lack of background. They cannot be accounted for on the basis of Pavlov's dogs. There are two ways we can see that. One, there are many people who are raised in Christian homes who repudiate Christianity. How does that figure if it's all a conditioned reflex? And there are other people who become Christians who have had nothing to do with Christianity and know nothing about Jesus Christ until they have been confronted with him. No, our experience is not merely a psychological experience, though there are obviously psychological aspects to it. It is based on an objective historical fact, namely Jesus Christ, and it is something that can be experienced in personal experience on the basis of that fact, and there are many other contemporary witnesses and evidence that this is the case. One other thing needs to be said, and that is that the laboratory in this case is human life. And as we go into the laboratory of human life, love, joy, peace, purpose in life, direction, are in a sense objective things. Whereas they were absent before, they are now present. These are significant pieces of data. And as we go into the laboratory of life, we find that Jesus Christ brings these things into people's life. And in the final analysis, then, of course, we can point out to people that they can experience this thing for themselves in Jesus Christ, and they can verify the hypothesis. Essentially, it's a scientific experiment. The hypothesis is Jesus Christ lived, died, and rose again. He is who he claimed to be. He can be experienced in personal experience. If a person meets his conditions, he can verify this hypothesis experimentally in his own life. The last question, and we won't take time to discuss it because I think it's fairly self-evident, but it's a frequent one. Why isn't just living the best life I can enough? What could God demand in doing the best, more than doing the best I can? Maybe we should just take one further minute to give an illustration. The basic problem that lays in people's minds with this is they have no concept of the infinite holiness of God and their own shortcoming. Dr. Barnhouse used to have a very useful illustration. He would say, suppose you line up the whole human race across or up and down the West Coast, and you say, now our objective is to swim to Hawaii. Hawaii is God's standard of righteousness. And the distance you get out into the ocean will be on the basis of the quality of your moral life. Oh man, here's this philosophy professor who's really a tremendous Joe. You know, he'd be the first to admit that he's imperfect, but he's a good man. And by anybody's standard, he's out there churning around at 75 miles an hour, you know, or 75 miles out, I should say. And here are the Joe College types, you know, they get soused every once in a while, and they cheat on a few exams, but they're not ready for Alcatraz or anything, and they're out here 10 miles an hour, and then here, or 10 miles out, and then here are all these bums from Skid Row, you know, they're just practically strangling 100 yards offshore. They've just about gotten off, shoved off. And all in between is the whole human race, determined by the quality of life that they live. Now, there's absolutely no question but that the quality of different people's lives is different, is there? I mean, we're not all the same. Some are much better than others. On a horizontal comparison, it's obvious. But what is that difference with reference to Hawaii? Nothing. None of us is going to make it to Hawaii, are we, on the basis of swimming there in our own strength? Absolutely not the first one of us, however good he or she may be. The only way anybody is going to get to Hawaii is if somebody takes them there. And that's exactly the way it is with us and Jesus Christ and God. Certainly there are some people who live far better lives than others. But none of us is going to make it on our own, and this is why God had to come into human history and make it possible for us to have forgiveness of sin and the righteousness of Jesus Christ, which in a sense takes us to Hawaii. So living the best we can is not enough. Sure, we can make it if we can live a life of absolute perfection, but we can't. And once we recognize that, we appreciate the gift of God for us in Jesus Christ. One concluding remark. Remember that the fact that an answer is not received by someone does not invalidate that answer. You will find some people who will say, that wall there, that wall's not there. It's all in your mind. That's your interpretation that wall is there. You know, I mean, that wall just isn't there. There is nothing in this wide world you can say, including knocking that guy's head against that wall, it's going to persuade him that that wall is there. If he insists on saying that black is white and he completely abandons any kind of reason or logic, at least you can help him to see, generally speaking, that he is at least inconsistent in his thinking, to say the least. So don't be discouraged if answers are not accepted. It doesn't vitiate them. But 9 times out of 10, or at least many times, you'll find that a reasonable approach to the gospel will be something that will help thoughtful people to discover Jesus Christ. Now, let's observe that man's basic problem in becoming a Christian is not intellectual, it's moral. And once you help a person to see that, you've gotten 80 yards down the field. I well remember one night in a fraternity, a fellow said to me, well, you know, this is very interesting. It's the first time I've ever heard anything that made sense. You satisfactorily answer all the questions that I have. I said, thank you very much. You're very kind. Are you going to become a Christian? Well, no, as a matter of fact. Well, I said, would you mind telling me why? He said, well, to be honest with you, it would mess up the way I'm living. He got the message. That there is a moral issue in Jesus Christ, in becoming a Christian, as well as an intellectual issue, and this is more devastating and holds more people back than the intellectual issue. But he now saw that it wasn't that he couldn't believe in Jesus Christ because he was so intellectual, as he maintained at the outset of the discussion, but it was that he wouldn't believe, and there's all the difference in the world. Several people have asked me to mention, whoops, no chalk. Well, tomorrow morning, you don't have to have a piece of chalk in your pocket, do you? There is a reprint from his magazine, What Non-Christians Ask, which I wrote up one time, which lists six of these questions and has in print most of the things we've talked about tonight and a little more in terms of bibliography and so on. And there is a series of eight articles that's reprinted in one little gizmo like this, only more pages, called Learn to Witness. It's a series of eight articles that covers the waterfront on approach, message, so forth and so forth, including a lot of the things we had to say last night and many more. That's also available. Tomorrow when we get a piece of chalk, we'll put the address on the blackboard where you can get hold of them if you're interested. Let's pray together.